Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, minus one, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 313 of Registry Matters, a nice palindrome number. How are you, sir?
Doing awesome. It's only 93 today.
Only 93? Compared to what it could be and has been, that's nice and comfortable.
Yeah, it's almost like winter's just around the corner.
Is that what it is after it's been 120 that 90 is winter?
Pretty close to it, yes.
I do have like a personal experience with that. So way back in the day, I was out there in the desert when I was in the army, and it's 120 in the middle of the desert there in California, and so if it's 90 or 80 at night, you're like freaking freezing.
I've heard people say that, but I have never found that to be the case with me. If it's above 80, I'm still miserable.
All right. Please like, subscribe, thumbs up, reviews. You all know what to do. And then if you want to be generous, head over to patreon.com and you can be like super patron Mike. I'm looking it up. He started in June of 2018. Holy moly, that's a long time later. That's like over 6 years.
Yes, and at $1,400 per month.
He has some funny stories about having his probation officer teach him a lesson back in the day that you would probably think is funny, but he does not think is funny.
We'll have to hear a couple of them one of these days.
Maybe we could get him on to tell us a funny story, as you would call it. Would you be so kind and tell us what we're doing tonight?
Well, we were planning on possibly taking this episode off, but early this morning, I received notification, and so did you, that there was a decision, and we're going to talk about that, from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And that is not a very favorable outcome out of the state of North Carolina. And we have a segment where I responded to listener feedback posted on YouTube. I'll go back and respond to that individual. We have a letter sent to us by a person in prison. He asked about two issues. The first issue is about leaving the country. I'm going to duck that one. The second is about interstate compact, and I'm going to respond to that. And we have a comment submitted to us by a treatment provider that you passed along. And everybody who was looking forward to hearing the soothing voice of Chance, he's not with us, so there's no California corner. And also, we have a few articles, and I've designated one if time permits.
Well, how about this? I think a little birdie told me that you have possibly some general rules for this episode.
As a matter of fact, I do. If you receive permission from the court to have internet access while you're under supervision, make sure to report those websites where you have internet access to your registration official if your state requires such disclosures.
Like if they say that you're allowed to use LinkedIn, tell them you're using LinkedIn? Is that what you mean?
If you're under supervision, if your conditions of supervision are you're not to access the internet. If you go to court and you're allowed access to the internet, then you may have, or you normally would have had permission to use the internet if you were merely a registrant, you still have an obligation to report that in most states. Those sites that you're accessing, you have to file those with your registry official. Make sure you make that disclosure.
I got you. Well, then do me a favor and tell me some more specifics about this, because I want to hear anything about internet is almost always interesting to me.
Well, according to an affidavit for arrest on April 12, 2024, Mr. Wilson, I guess that's Wilson with two L's, petitioned to be able to access the internet. He was granted a consent order modifying his sentence. In the order, Mr. Wilson could only access the internet for education, employment, housing, healthcare, and banking purposes. Now listen to the dates. On April 12th, 2024, Agent Parker and South Carolina probation performed a home visit at Mr. Wilson's registered address. Agent Parker advised me, I'm reading from the report, that one of the conditions of his probation is that Agent Parker can access Mr. Wilson's electronic devices. Agent Parker advised me that Mr. Wilson had two cell phones. While examining these electronic devices, Agent Parker discovered that Mr. Wilson had access to the Wi-Fi at his registered address. This private network requires a password to access the Spectrum router inside the residence, and I have no idea what that means. Agent Parker advised me that the password access to the internet was saved on Mr. Wilson's phone. Agent Parker was able to send me pictures of Mr. Wilson's iPhone. These show that Mr. Wilson had access to the internet with the password. Wilson had not registered those with the state, and he now faces prosecution and likely incarceration because his probation will likely be revoked.
That's interesting. For clarity, Spectrum is his internet provider. That's the name of the company.
Okay.
So I see that the affidavit, that there is an affidavit for arrest, and it states, there is probable cause to believe that Mr. Wilson has access to the internet and has not reported the access to Greenville County PFR registration office within 3 days. And I presented the facts of this case to Judge Horn, and after careful consideration, Judge Horn issued a warrant for failure to register.
General rule, if you go to court to modify your sentence while you're under supervision, there's a strong possibility that the probation officer may not act the way you would expect. In his mind, he thought, well, the judge says I have to be allowed this access and I'm home free. It never occurred to him what was going to happen. And if he had been a client of ours, I would have told him, they're likely to come down on you with a pickaxe. We can file this motion. But if we do it, here's what they're going to do. And then I would be Mr. Gloom and Doom, and they would run down and hire another lawyer who didn't tell them that is what they would have done.
So he got permission from the judge, if I'm understanding this right, he got permission from the judge to be able to use the internet, which for education, employment, housing, healthcare, those like kind of like fundamental uses that everyone should be allowed to do. Is that, I mean, like a reasonable way to put it? Like, if you're going to go get some education, there's free education all over the internet. You can't go to bkjobs.com without the internet. You can probably answer this better. I would imagine that applying for most government programs can be done online, and it would be easier and more efficient to do it online.
Yes, but he didn't report it to the state registration office.
Right. And they're pissed off at him because he went behind their back?
Not because it went behind the back. The probation officers, you got to understand their mindset. They believe themselves that they know more about you than the judge does. And they believe that if, in their opinion, you shouldn't have access and you go petition for access to the internet, that you have undermined their authority and their control over you. So their reaction is, we're going to come looking for something to violate you for so we can show the judge that he's wrong and we're right. That's the way they think.
Yeah, my whole experience is way different than this, like you were saying in pre-show, that I had a very, very, very different experience than what a lot of people do. And I realized that I was incredibly fortunate for all of that it turned out to be.
You were indeed. And I can't guarantee you that bad things are going to happen, but I always tell the client, this is what could happen. You need to be remarkably clean in everything you do, because this could set off a chain reaction of things that we're not going to like. I tell people that, and then they get mad because I'm gloom and doom.
Well, you are pretty doom and gloom, hence the picture that I have picked. And I will no longer rotate them because, well, it's just who you are. What are we doing here with this letter? You like kind of almost like sprung this on me at the last second because you didn't even put it in the show notes.
It's in the show notes. You were just smoking so much wacky weed you can't see it. But it's we're going to read parts of it. It's a two-part question. He wants to leave the country, and I do not in any way advise people on that. And he wanted to contact Mr. Whitsitt, who was a guest a long time ago. I don't have any contact information, but he asked something I do understand, interstate compact. So that's the part we're going to read of the letter, and then I'm going to answer that portion.
And you redacted everything so that I knew exactly where to go. And it says, my name is Dennis, and I took a bench trial in Kankakee. Is that what that is?
I think it's Kankakee.
Kankakee County in Illinois in 2016, lost that trial and was found guilty of predatory criminal blah, blah, blah in 2016. I was sentenced to 11 years at 85% and was due to be released in February earlier this year. However, after being caught with a contraband, we'll call it a cell phone, and a year into a sentence, he was charged and sentenced an additional 3 years that he is serving now, and he's set to be released in February of 27. So I'm, you know, as things go, it's just a handful of years away. My parole here will be 3 years to life. I've got through my appeals process and still have my actual in what is that?
Do you think I'm actually looking at it?
I was hope so. I still have my actual innocence claim. Oh, I guess I still have my actual innocence claim left to file, but I cannot do this until I'm released. This is my dilemma. So, Uncle Larry, once I am released, I will be mandated to take a complete sex offender treatment. This treatment requires me to take responsibility for the crime I was convicted of, as well as force me to pay thousands of dollars for the treatment. I must also submit to and pay for polygraph examinations. If I refuse any of these things, the treatment provider contacts my PO and notifies them that I am not complying. The policy is for my parole agent to violate me and send me back to prison for a minimum of 2 years. Once I get out, I will have to go through the same process and get sent back for another 2 years. You see, I cannot take or participate in treatment. If I am still appealing my case, so I go back to prison for 2 years, get released, go back to prison again and again. That's an interesting conundrum, Larry, actually.
It is. And then the last part, below the X's, is the real
question.
There's
more below the X's. Okay, sorry. In the meantime, I am looking to get an interstate compact to a state that gives me at least some chance of getting off parole, a place with less restriction than Illinois. And after reviewing the book Your Life on the List by Derek Logue, New Mexico sounds like the ideal place to settle down. Oh, you're going to have an opinion about that one for sure. I have money saved up to start my life over when I get out. All I have to do is find a place. Are there any resources out there that can help me with the asylum process, or resources that can help me find a place to parole to in New Mexico? I hope to hear back soon. Respectfully.
So, well, now the neat thing about this is this letter was written to the podcast, even though he's not connected to us. It was written to Registry Matters. I didn't have to take this from Norsall's mail flow. But I love these things that he asked, because we haven't talked about interstate compact for many, many episodes. Well, what he's dealing with is an indeterminate period of parole they call mandatory supervised release, MSR, in Illinois. Very similar to what we do here. It's 3 to life. It's 5 to 20 here, and in some cases, 5 to life, depending on the offense. And the bad news for this gentleman is that mandatory supervised release is imposed by Illinois, and Illinois controls it. You will not be able to go to a state that can remove it. Only the state that imposed it can remove it or modify it. So that means, I mean, just think about this and it'll make perfect sense to you. Wouldn't it be a great country if you could get in trouble in one state and you could go to another state and they could undo that punishment and remove it from you? Wouldn't it be a fantastic country if it worked that way?
It would be. And then I got to think, Larry, that you could commit the crime in one state and then go to the other one. And they were like, oh, no, that's illegal here. And then you would get charged for it. You have to think about it both ways.
Absolutely. Well, this is a situation where people, they misunderstand the compact, the interstate compact for adult offender supervision. That 3 to life will go to New Mexico or to whatever state he should go to. And the only state that can remove it would be the state that imposed it, Illinois. And I will guarantee you this. New Mexico will not assist you in any way and getting your supervision terminated. They will not make a recommendation for you. They will make it very difficult for you to travel. If you were to actually petition for removal, whatever that process is in Illinois, they will make it very difficult for you. You'll have to work at getting back to Illinois to appear in person if that's required. And so that is a no-starter there. In terms of the conditions, all of those conditions go with you that Illinois imposed if they're part of your MSR, your mandatory supervised release. Again, wouldn't it be a fantastic country if you could just jump around and hopscotch the nation and you could have your conditions removed? So all the conditions that you read that he's going to be required to do to get counseling, they will follow him. Polygraph, if that's in his MSR rules that he signs at Illinois, they will go with him to New Mexico or any other state. So he will be forced to abide by those in whatever state he goes to. He will achieve absolutely nothing by leaving Illinois, in my opinion. Nothing. And in fact, he'll do just the opposite. He will make his situation worse by leaving Illinois because he'll get hung up in that conundrum of probable cause hearing for a violation. New Mexico probation parole have arrest and detain powers without having to get a warrant for violations. They can issue a PO hold and put him in custody. And since it's not a very well-defined process how to get a probable cause determination hearing in the receiving state, he will languish in custody here for a long period of time, largely forgotten and off people's radar. And he will eventually sign a waiver of extradition to go back to Illinois to have his adjudicatory hearing on his violation. And it'll be difficult for him to put on a good hearing in a place where the evidence is not, because the violation would have occurred in New Mexico if he were to come here. And I don't advise him doing that. I think he's been getting some bad advice in prison. And I don't want to say anything bad about Derek Logue, but I don't know where he gets this idea about being an ideal place to settle down. We have some of the strictest PFR supervision regimens in the country here. So I don't know where he found that information. But if you come here, you're not going to likely find it what he's hoping for. It's not going to work out that way.
It sounds like the various conditions of the treatment and the polygraph and all that stuff, that's pretty standard. Wouldn't you agree?
Pretty standard. But even if it weren't, say he went to Vermont and say those liberal lefty pointy head nut jobs up there didn't require that. They're obligated to require it because it's in his conditions and they're acting right as an agent for Illinois. So they have to do it there. And the only exceptions would be if they're not allowed to, if it's something that their courts have ruled that they're not allowed to do there, then they have to communicate to the sending state, which would be Illinois. We can't do that here. You'll have to remove that condition or we'll have to decline the transfer. But they're obligated to enforce these conditions because the sending state imposed them.
Now, I want to be clear about something that he said. Is his issue with treatment, one of them is that he is claiming innocence? I don't remember reading that.
Yes, that is then one of his...
Yes. Okay. All right, because like that's a significant thing. If I've always wondered about how do you go through treatment if they're going to mandate that you take ownership of it, and you know, I did this thing, I'm responsible for it, I'm an adult, I can take responsibility for my actions. But there are people who are innocent of what they have been found guilty of, Larry. And it would be a really challenging thing to then go in there and go, yep, I did it, when you didn't do it. That would be challenging.
Well, it would also undermine his appeal. If I'm the attorney on the other side of that appeal, I'm going to say, well, you know what? We've got his own admission. He signed his sexual history disclosure. He did this. He did that. And that's the whole irony of this kabuki exercise in treatment that they use. Because all it is a collaborative fishing expedition. It's not about treatment.
I'm aware. I still love the word kabuki. It's really a fabulous word.
I agree. We should use it more often.
I think so. All right. Well, this kabuki comment came in. Just kidding. No, this is a real comment that I fielded originally. And I kicked the guy back a little bit and was like, I don't think you quite have that the way you think it was. But anywho, so there was a comment left on YouTube from a person who was about to become a patron until Larry, you said that the registry is not cruel and unusual punishment. And I would like for you to respond to the YouTube listener. What do you have to say to that you said it's not cruel and unusual punishment?
Well, I mean, those words did come from my mouth, but that's not me saying that.
You're not taking responsibility for you saying it? Sorry.
it's the courts themselves saying that. Conservative justices such as Antonin Scalia have proclaimed the cruel and unusual punishment clauses to be interpreted as the words were understood at the time they were written into the Constitution. Conservative interpretation does not provide for the evolving standards of decency, which is a creation of the liberals under Chief Justice Earl Warren. If you don't like this type of judicial interpretation, you should consider voting for a presidential candidate that does not promise to make appointments of those who will not legislate from the bench. Because what you're really hoping for is a little bit of legislating from the bench. And you don't get that from originalists. There is no such thing as evolving standards of decency. So that's what, it's not me saying that. That was a conservative icon saying that. Those were his words. And I do that a lot of times when I say things like, you don't want legislating from the bench. That is my tongue in cheek trying to provoke thought from the audience, because many of our audience believe that they're originalist. They believe they're textualist. They believe that they don't like legislating from the bench. And I'm throwing it back at them saying, hey, if you think that you're a textualist, here's what you get with textual interpretation. So this is me trying to give you real-time connections to what you think you believe in.
Now, Larry, while you were doing that rant, I did some research. And I found a decision that was Tropp versus Dulles, and that is 356 U.S. Code 86 from 1958. That was almost when you were approaching retirement age, even. And that was Chief Justice Earl Warren who said, the Eighth Amendment must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. Subsequently, the court was looked to societal developments as well as looking to its own independent judgment in determining what are those evolving standards of decency. In Kennedy versus Louisiana in 2008, the Supreme Court stated, evolving standards of decency must embrace and express respect for the dignity of the person, and the punishment of criminals must conform to that rule. Originalists like Justice Antonin Scalia argue that societies must rot instead of maturing and may decrease in virtue or wisdom instead of increasing. Thus, they say the framers wanted the amendment understood as it was written and ratified, instead of morphing as times change. And in any event, legislators are more competent than judges to take the pulse of the public as to the changing standards of decency.
Yes, and you meant to say may rot rather than must rot. But that is the Scalia and the conservative doctrine, that you do not ask judges to evolve the Constitution. You ask the voters to evolve the Constitution. And if you want the Constitution to be more broad, you, the voters, have to do that. We don't do that from the bench here. And it sounds to me like a lot of people don't understand that. If you firmly believe that the Constitution should be interpreted as it was originally understood the words to mean in colonial times, then you shouldn't be surprised when they say the death penalty is not unconstitutional, because it's not cruel, nor is it unusual, as those words were understood to be what they were understood to mean in colonial times. Every state, I think, had a death penalty, as Scalia has said, and we've played clips of that multiple times. But it's not me saying it. It's me repeating what judicial interpretation is. I'm saying that if you can put someone to death with all the cruel means that we use, being listed in a database doesn't approach being tortured to death over the course of several minutes, and sometimes over hours, you know, when these executions are botched. If that isn't cruel and unusual punishment, you're not going to get there under this judicial philosophy that we don't have evolving standards of societal decency.
And to then pile on top of that, though, we could change it if we wanted to, as far as the death penalty goes. We could say that this is the new standard, and what would it be, the 28th Amendment? We could say no more death by the state, right?
We could do that, and states have enacted their own laws. We repealed our death penalty in 2009.
But we could do it as a country, as all 59 states of us. We could all pull together and we could say, this is the thing, two-thirds of the states go along with it and all that, and then we can have a new amendment, and then there's no execution at the state level, period, end of story.
We could do that, but we can't pass it because that's not where the people are of this country. They are not at that level yet. But we could do that, yes.
We could, and then that would set the floor of that standard of decency, and then that takes that off the table. We could do this as a people if we wanted to, but as you've just said, and I'm with you, that's not where we are. So just having your name listed on a list and having some, mamby-pamby restrictions that you can't go here or there. Comparatively, it's not cruel. Comparatively.
Well, again, that would be the way I would look at the most gruesome things that are done. The states are proposing some really awful ways of executing people. And if we can do these things using these cruel methods of prolonged agony, and that's not cruel and unusual, it's hard for me to imagine anything that would come close. So I'm going by a conservative interpretation. But in fairness to Scalia, he has a point. Why is it not possible that society could devolve? So you could have devolving standards of decency. He says if you buy into the evolving standards of decency, that things always evolve for the better, how come they can't evolve not so good? He has a point there.
Absolutely has a point. Can I read a comment from a chat from a long, long, long time patron?
Certainly.
It goes along with this. They used to shoot horse thieves. They don't do that now either. Things have changed. If I could be banished from my city, but never have to deal with the registry again in any other city, I take that cruel and unusual punishment over the registry. Cruel and unusual is being doxxed no matter where I go. The Constitution was written when Larry was a toddler. In my opinion, cruel and unusual should be changed.
Then let's do it. Let's work on that.
All right, we should get right on that. Moving along then.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well then let's move over to this main event because, well, it's time. And this is the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld North Carolina's PFR registration law. According to a statement from leadership at North Carolina RSOL, the ruling is a gross miscarriage of justice. And then do you agree with that statement, sir? Doing your unqualified legal practice, what do you call it?
Unauthorized practice of law.
That's the one.
I'm close, but I'm not sure I agree completely. I'm certainly disappointed with the decision, but I don't think I would call it a gross miscarriage of justice.
Not gross? Okay. May we set this up a bit?
Sure, go for it.
All right. Well, if you aren't familiar with this case, so two nonprofit groups had challenged the law in federal court, arguing that it violated offenders' constitutional right against ex post facto punishment. Those nonprofits were NARSAL. Are you familiar with them?
I've heard of them, yes.
And then there's the North Carolina affiliate, which is called NCRSOL. A unanimous three-judge appellate panel agreed with a trial court that the plaintiffs did not offer the clearest of proof. Would you remind us what that standard is?
The clearest of proof? Well, I'll pray about it first, see if I can recollect it. I was getting ready to delete some notes here that shouldn't have been in this segment, this paragraph. But the clearest of proof is an evidentiary standard. when you hear this, like beyond a reasonable doubt, that would be a standard that's applied in a criminal case. And then you get on the civil side of the ledger, you're looking at evidentiary standards as well. And you'll hear standards like preponderance of the evidence, which is a tip of the scale slightly. Clearest of proof is the highest evidentiary standard in a civil proceeding when you've got a burden of proof. So you've got to show by the clearest of proof when you're attacking a constitutional standard that there's no set of circumstances that this could be applied constitutionally. If you're doing a facial challenge, if you're doing an as-applied challenge, you've got to show by the clearest of proof that it cannot be applied to you. This is the sentence I was going to delete right here.
Well, I hope you get to it because I'm almost there.
We put that down below, remember? If you want to play it now, you can.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, whichever way you want to do it, we can run it either way. So the plaintiffs did not offer the clearest of proof that PFR registration is sufficiently punitive to violate the U.S. Constitution. God, that kind of ties into the whole cruel and unusual punishment from a minute ago. And we did discuss this case back in 282. For anyone who wants more details, but I have a short clip. It's like almost exactly 1 minute long, and I'm going to play it, and then I will try to remember to not play it when we get to the end. But so this is from 282. Do you think, sir, that this will be appealed?
I understand the notice of appeal has already been filed.
And will that one work?
This is such a well-written opinion. It took 2 years from the trial, a little over 2 years, to render this opinion. And there's so many deferences that go to the trial judge on weighting the credibility of these witnesses, determining who to believe, how much weight to give each person's testimony. It's hard for me to believe that there's a good chance of this being overturned on appeal. Now, I certainly hope that it is, because we are fully invested in this case, both the national and the state chapter, but it's hard for me to see that this is going to be an easy lift to overturn.
Something got cut off early. I think we got the gist, though.
Yes, what I was saying there was the deference to the trial judge. When you're in an appeal, you're not retrying the case. And that judge, whose name escapes me, she put so much diligence into writing the opinion, her findings of facts and conclusions of law, that it was almost impossible to imagine a scenario where that would be overturned. It just didn't seem likely. So that was what I was talking about in 282. So those who want more details about the case that weren't around when we talked about it in November of last year, we went into great detail on Register Matters, episode number 282.
And it's towards the end. It probably starts somewhere in the 50-minute mark, give or take. I didn't see exactly where it started.
About 55, 56 minutes where I've made that comment. But yeah, that whole episode really focused on this case. We went into great detail.
And is it fair to say that you didn't really have high hopes for the appeal? And if so, why?
Well, despite the fact that the case proceeded to trial, some of the witnesses testified in a manner that did not support our assertions, meaning from our side. They claimed that they could not find jobs, yet they were working. They claimed that they could not find insecure housing, yet they were not homeless. And they claimed that they had been banished, yet they had not been banished. These are just a few things that went wrong during the trial. Witness preparation is everything when you go to trial. Now, the lawyer that handled the case, he asked for summary judgment, and the judge denied him summary judgment because there were too many factual questions that needed to be answered. And at trial, the witnesses just did not come across very well. And that's some of that could have been lack of prep. And it could be that, that they just didn't have anything credible to say, because it's one thing to say that you can't find a job, but if you've been working and never been without a job, it's not a very credible statement to make now, is it?
It wouldn't seem so. Just out of curiosity, if you're quote-unquote working, but let's just say you have a PhD in astrophysics or something, and you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, you are employed, but you're not employed at the highest level of your caliber. Would that count?
I don't think so, unless you proved it. Remember, clearest of proof.
Okay. I gotcha.
You've got to come in with evidence that would show that it was the registry that kept you from being employed at your full potential. A lot of people are not employed at their full potential that are not on the registry.
That's true, too. Well, Dwayne Daughtry was quoted as saying, "This ruling fails to recognize the basic tenets of justice and human rights. The unanimous decision by the three-judge panel, which asserts that the law does not violate constitutional rights, is a stark reminder of how far removed our legal system can be from fairness, especially when it comes to individuals on PFR registrations who are no longer under some kind of supervision, probation, or parole." Do you agree with that?
Yes, generally I do agree with that.
He went on to state, "The crux of the court's ruling rests on the assertion that the PFR registry is a civil, non-punitive measure intended to protect public safety. Yet for those subject to its harsh restrictions, this law is anything but non-punitive. It imposes severe limitations on where they can live, work, or even visit, effectively turning their daily existence into a minefield of potential felony charges for mere technical violations. This is particularly egregious for individuals who have served their time, are not on probation or parole, and are supposedly free citizens." Now, do you agree with that part?
I do indeed. He stated that succinctly. The question is, did they offer the clearest of proof at trial on those allegations? The trial court, and now the Court of Appeals, said unanimously that they failed and that they did not.
"Registrants may not knowingly reside within 1,000 feet of a school or child care center. Most registrants can't knowingly visit any place intended primarily for the use or care of minors, such as schools or playgrounds, and some are restricted from being within 300 feet of any such place when it's located within an area not intended for such use, such as malls. And most can't visit any place that minors frequently congregate when minors are present, such as libraries, parks, and pools." Now, what's your spin on that part?
Well, there's really nothing to spin here. Registrants have not been banished, as the word has been defined by binding legal precedent. Remember, we have to interpret by what words were understood to have meant at the time they were put in the Constitution. We cannot evolve. Remember? That we just went through that
above. I believe we've heard this.
Okay, so banishment, as it was understood to those who used the word back in colonial times, meant when they said, "Boy, you out of town here, you come back, we're going to throw you in jail, we're going to kill you." Nobody's been banished. They have not been told to leave town and never come back. So it is not banishment in the literal interpretation of originalism.
Now, look, I can't let you get off on this one, Larry. It says, "Dwayne stated the reasoning is deeply flawed when nearly half of the housing in cities like Charlotte and Raleigh are off limits, and when registrants are forced into living under bridges or in tent encampments, the line between restriction and banishment becomes dangerously thin." Now, why can't you please admit that registrants have been banished?
Well, I'll let Chief Judge Albert Diaz's opinion. He addressed that argument that North Carolina restrictions amount to a form of banishment. According to the court, the fact that registrants can live in some parts of North Carolina, even if those options are drastically limited, means they have not been expelled from the community, which is what banishment meant in colonial times.
Are we here?
Yep.
Now, I see this as futile with you, as most things are, Larry. Dwayne stated, "The court's decision to uphold these draconian restrictions as non-punitive flies in the face of the constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws. The ex post facto clause was designed to prevent the government from retroactively increasing the punishment for a crime after it had been committed. Yet, this is precisely what North Carolina's registry law does. It imposes new, lifelong punishments on individuals who have already served their sentences, trapping them in a cycle of fear and uncertainty, all under the guise of civil regulation." Now, can you agree with that?
I do agree with parts of that. The registry of most states does impose punishment. Not all states, but in most states. Unfortunately, we continue to fail in our responsibility to provide the clearest of proof. We, the challengers, bear that burden when attacking a statute on constitutional grounds. Quit making excuses and let's get the job done.
Now tell me, why is it not a violation of ex post facto a clause?
Well, I'm going to let the court tell you. As the court explained, the ex post facto clause forbids the application of any new punitive measure to a crime already committed. To determine whether a challenged law imposes punishment, the Supreme Court has developed a two-pronged inquiry. First, we must consider consider whether the legislature meant to establish civil proceedings. If not, in the intention of the legislature was to impose punishment, that ends the inquiry. Meaning, if the lawmakers were stupid enough to say we want to punish people by registration, then there'd be no further inquiry because that would end it. But if the legislature stated they intended to enact a regulatory scheme that is civil non-punitive, we proceed to the second step. That is to ask whether the statute is so punitive, either in purpose or effect, as to negate the state's intention to deem it civil. But because we ordinarily defer to the legislature's stated intent, only the clearest proof will suffice to override legislative intent and transform what has been denominated as a civil remedy into a criminal penalty. And that's on page 7-8 of the opinion.
On page 13, the court stated, since we conclude that the legislature intended to create a civil, non-punitive regime, plaintiffs can prevail only by showing that the law's punitive effect is so overwhelming that it negates the state's non-punitive intentions. Now, how would they do that? What is the next test?
Well, it's that Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez set of factors that we've talked about so often on this program. The inquiry generally asks whether the registration statute is, one, has a rational correction to a non-punitive purpose, two, is excessive with respect to its purposes, three, has been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment, four, imposes any disability or restraint, which is my favorite, five, promotes the traditional aims of punishment. They went on to say, despite some overlap between them, we consider each of these factors in turn and determine whether the sum provides the clearest proof that the registry is punitive in effect. And that's on page 13 of the opinion. And they didn't go into the number one about scienter that we talked about last week. They didn't use that.
Oh, Jesus. That word. It sounds like a weapon when you say scienter. Now, as usual, Larry, I'm quite flabbergasted that you cannot seem to ever admit that there are significant disabilities and restraints imposed by registration in North Carolina or in most states. Now, why can't you see that people are effectively banished? If that's not a disability or restraint, what would be on the list that would be?
Well, if they were truly being banished, that would be a disability restraint. But as the court stated, to begin with, registrants may still live in much of North Carolina. Plaintiffs presented evidence that 49% of the housing in Charlotte and 48.3% in Raleigh and 42.8% in Greensboro would be off limits. If I'm not mistaken, I think that still leaves the majority, more than half, of each of those metropolitan areas available, demonstrating that registrants aren't expelled from the community. And they relied on McGuire versus Strange, which you remember that case from Alabama, from the 11th Circuit, rejecting a comparison to banishment where 80% of the housing was off limits to registrants. So 50%, 48, 42, and 49% is certainly less than 80%. Would you agree with that?
I'm pretty sure that 49 is less than 80. So what would it take then to convince you?
More evidence for one thing, and that still might not be enough. We're stuck with conservative courts that interpret the words as they were understood at the time they were written. Banishment has a longstanding legal definition already. The court pointed out that the resident restriction has exceptions, also undermines any comparison to banishment. Although registrants generally may not live within 1,000 feet of a school or child care center, they may do so if the facility opens after the registrant establishes the residence. And because registrants are not even completely prohibited from living in proximity to schools and daycare centers, the law doesn't come close to expelling them from the community, which is what banishment is understood to mean from when that clause was created.
Now, I need to kick the soapbox out from underneath you. We need to wrap this up. But then, so just to wrap things up, on the final page, the court stated, having considered each of the factors individually, we must now balance them to determine whether the sum provides the clearest proof that the registry is punitive in effect. Though the registration statute imposes difficult burdens on qualifying offenders and furthers the goals of punishment to some extent, the remaining factors, including the most important one, of all the one all favor the state. On balance, we can't say that the record evidence shows the clearest of proof that the statute is so excessive that it negates the legislature's plainly non-punitive intent. Accordingly, the district court's judgment is affirmed. Now, what do they do next?
In my opinion, the case is effectively over. They could request reconsideration from the panel, or they could ask for en banc, which is a full court review of all the judges on the Fourth Circuit. I'd expect both of those requests would be denied, and also they could file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, but I would have great trepidation with that move as well. It's not that good of a case to take up to the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court did grant the cert petition, they did review the case, and they did uphold the Fourth Circuit, then we have no hope of ever ending registration. And we would be stuck with this for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, would this start to move into one of those areas of this was a decision we did not need? Is that the way you word it?
It's absolutely a decision. We need it, but we're not. The court isn't constructed, in my view, to where we could run the risk of asking this court, as it's currently constructed, to make a ruling, in particular with a case that's lacking in evidence. You read in the preceding paragraph about the evidence not being there, and the Supreme Court will not be able to introduce new evidence into the record. I mean, they could, I guess, grant cert, remand it, and say it needs better development, but this is a crappy case, in my opinion. It did not get the kind of traction that we would have liked. We're very disappointed, but it's over.
Now, I'm going to need you to fill in the gap a little bit. I'm going to try and make an analogy of someone saying that they were denied housing because they are of a minority, that the owner didn't like them because they were, pick your color, black, white, red, indifferent, purple, whatever. But you have to get them to get the owner of the property to go, that's right, I didn't rent it to you because you were a pug. And I mean that as the dog breed, because I don't want to use any white, black, race. I don't want to use any of those words. So you are a Labrador, therefore you didn't get rented to. But they're never going to tell you that, so you have to come up with all kinds of other shenanigans to figure out that, oh, well, they rented to this other person who was the same race, who made less money, all these other things, and they didn't rent it to me simply because of. You'd have to find a pattern to show that. That would be really hard to do.
Oh, it's not that hard to do. It's done. I was in housing for 17 years. They do that with testers. They okay. Test your property with shoppers, and they find out if you magically have vacancies when the right type of person comes in, and you magically are full when the wrong type of person comes in, and they bust you to heartbeat doing that.
But overlay that on us, that you need to go find some people that have similar qualifications, et cetera, and have them go apply for the job that you didn't get. And now you're only being denied the job because of the registry. Like, how do you prove that you were denied these different things simply because of that, to then show the clearest of proof that the registry is punitive and so forth?
Well, you would spend a bunch of money on getting investigators to go talk to HR people around the state. And you would try to get them off the record to say the things that you're looking for and how they treat applicants that are on the PFR list. You look for any public proclamations on their websites about their policies of who they will and will not employ. And it's a very expensive endeavor. But you cannot just take the word for a person who didn't get a job they wanted to say that they got discriminated because they're on the registry. That is not the clearest of proof.
I'm trying to make that comparison. It seems like that would be, I don't think it would be hard to get the HR person saying, no, we're not going to hire those people. I don't think that would be that hard to do.
It wouldn't be, but you got to do it.
I'm with you on that part. There was a guy that had a YouTube channel. He was called The Outspoken Offender. And he recorded a video, Larry, of him calling apartment complexes in his area.
I remember that.
And he called them. He's like, hey, I'm convicted of a blah, blah, blah. Would you rent to me? And they were like, click.
That would potentially count as evidence. We would, if I were on the other side of that case, I would want to look at your evidence because I need to know who you were calling. I need to know that you can set this up with your friends. I need to know that these are bona fide you know, that there's some legitimacy to this. But you could set that up in a way that would be credible evidence. But just simply having a bunch of recordings standing alone, no, I would get those thrown out.
But it was funny on the video. Click. Oh no. I'm sorry. We won't take your kind here. Is this hypocrisy section short? Because we're at 50 minutes.
It's very short. We've got time to do this one. I've got one article here about hypocrisy, and it ties a little bit to criminal stuff because it deals with the police. So let's do this hypocrisy.
Now, this comes from the AP, which, boy, is about as middle of the road and factual. Listen, if you're listening to stuff that's on the chart at the very bottom, it's not true. This is the true stuff. You put one in here that to illustrate hypocrisy, and it says Missouri voters have once again passed a constitutional amendment requiring Kansas City to spend at least a quarter of its budget on police. And that's up from 20% previously. Tuesday's vote highlights tension between Republicans in power statewide who are concerned about the possibility of police funding being slashed and leaders of the roughly 28% black city who say it should be up to them how to spend their local tax dollars.
Well, this is one of the many examples of political hypocrisy from our dear and beloved friends on the conservative side of the aisle. They proclaim that they have a strong belief that local control is always best, and that is until the locals take actions that they don't agree with, and then magically they deviate from that. Missouri did the same thing in the minimum wage. Locals voted, I think it was even in Kansas City some years ago, to require a higher minimum wage, and if it wasn't Kansas City, it was St. Louis. But the state legislature preempted them with a statewide ban on local control over wages. So much for local control, but I just want to point out this hypocrisy because these are talking points that sound good. We believe in local control. Well, no, you really don't. You believe in it until they go against something that you believe in more. And this is an example of that. But keep going.
All right. Well, the article quotes State Senator Tony Lutkemeyer. There's some letters in there that should not go together, Larry. And it quotes him as saying, in Missouri, we defend our police. We don't defund them. Now, what about that?
Well, it's a great scare tactic. You know, that came out after George Floyd. You know, when there was local communities in Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis that were looking at reallocating some police resources to alternative approach. But that's a scare tactic, especially since nobody has ever proposed defunding the police. It's a catchy phrase that generates an emotional reaction. Kansas City leaders have vehemently denied any intention of ending the police department. This strategy has worked well in other cities that were attempting police reforms, and they will keep doing it because it keeps working.
The article quotes Gwen Grant, president of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. Grant stated, "We do not have control of our police department, but we are required to fund it."
So much for the lip service about local control. In a statement Wednesday, Mayor Quentin Lucas hinted at a possible rival amendment being introduced that stands for local control of our communities. And this dates back to Civil War. The article states, in 1861, during the Civil War, Confederacy supporter and then Governor Claiborne Fox Jackson persuaded the legislature to pass a law giving state control over a local police department in St. Louis. That statute remained in place until 2013, when voters approved a constitutional amendment returning police to local control. Now, a little more than a decade later, the state wants to be in control again. How ironic, Andy.
That's so bizarre.
Can you finally admit that this is funny?
Okay, now, if I'm not mistaken, we have had conversations about when we don't want the police to do a thing, we are in control of that by not voting for some schmuck named Gary Long, things like that. This kind of puts that on its head, doesn't it?
It sure does. And but particularly, it's being led by people who claim that they believe so much in local control. That's the irony.
Isn't that the organization that can most have their thumb on the pulse is at the lowest level possible, right? Your city council, your city mayor, those things, those people.
That's what they claim.
Just checking. I just wanted to be clear that we were on the same page.
Yes, that's what they say.
Do you have anything else before we head out?
Just clarifying if we're going to record an episode next week. I think you're traveling.
Not yet. We're starting to get close. I'm going out of town right there at the second of last week. I leave on the 20th, I think it is, or the 21st. I'll be gone for a week. But we can certainly skip. We can skip all of them. Just saying.
Okay,
I also know what? I do want to make sure that I acknowledge that a very, 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 very dear friend of mine had a massive loss in their family. And I want to make sure to give a shout out that the passing of a family member was devastating. And I want to make sure that it's recognized and send all your well wishes to a patron of the program.
Well, shout out. Thank you.
Head over to registrymatters.co and you can find all the show notes there. Leave voicemail 747-227-4477. Registrymatterscast@gmail.com if you want to send hate mail to Larry. And then you can head over to patreon.com/registrymatters if you would become a supporter. And for as little as a dollar a month, you get the show early. And I can you can get in here early or stay late and talk to Larry after the program if you want some of the perks. And then, you'll get access to the Discord server, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And without anything else, Larry, I hope you have a fabulous evening. And I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.